Sometimes an obituary doesn't do justice to the life. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. With us on the phone today is Mo Rocca. He is a correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning, host of the Henry Ford's Innovation Nation, and My Grandmother's Ravioli. He's also a frequent panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And he has a new book out. It's called Mobituaries, Great Lives Worth Reliving. And we'll talk with him about some of the people, places, and things he thought needed a better send-off. And I think he's right. I had a lot of fun reading this book. I laughed a lot, but I also learned quite a bit about the people that, and the things that he talks about in the book. And maybe you've read the book already. What surprised you about it? Who do you think needs a little more recognition? Mo Rocca, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us.
Larry, thank you for having me. Good to be with you.
Oh, man, I had a lot of fun with this book.
Good.
Oh, actually, before the book, there was the Mobituary podcast.
That's right. That's right. And we're still doing the podcast.
Yes.
And there's some overlap, but the book is about 60% new material. But the podcast is going strong.
Yeah. And well, you come up with some crazy ideas anyway, and some wonderful ideas. But where did the idea for this come from?
My father loved obituaries. He always said that obits were the favorite part of the newspaper for him, and he was not a gloomy or morbid person at all. My father had a real sense of the romance of life, and that makes sense that he'd love obits, because obits are really about someone's life, not about their death. A good one, to me, feels like the movie trailer, the preview for an Oscar-winning biopic. It kind of has a sweep to it and leaves you breathless. It's a profile of a person's life, the highs, the lows, and hopefully the survival into old age.
Well, it was, I don't even know how you found time to put it all together, to be honest. You're so busy.
Well, I am, but I'm a research hound. A lot of these are ideas I've been sitting with for a long time, it was a thrill to sort of push them out into the world.
Well, let's get to the book itself and tell our listeners what they're going to find when they read it.
The subtitle of the book is Mobituaries, Great Lives Worth Reliving. So these are people and things that I don't think got the send-off that they deserved. Now, some of them are household names like Sammy Davis Jr. or Audrey Hepburn, who I think are worth revisiting because I don't think that they're remembered in the way they should be remembered. Some of these are people that were once wildly famous, like Von Meter, who became extremely famous for impersonating John F. Kennedy. And after the assassination of President Kennedy, Von Meter's career died, and he spent 40 more years alive as unfortunately a living reminder of a horrible day. So had become sort of a pariah. And some are people that were never recognized properly in their lifetime. Some civil rights pioneers that a full century before the people we rightly think of as pioneers. And some are things. I wanted to give a send-off to the station wagon, which died in 2011, but really began its long decline in 1983 with the introduction of the minivan, which, can you believe it, Larry, was once thought of as a kind of sexy vehicle. And I also wanted to say goodbye to certain beliefs. The first chapter is called Death of the Fantastic. It's an essay about the death of the belief in dragons. For millennia, people believed that dragons were real until a Swedish botanist named Carl Linnaeus came along in 1735, and he went to a hot exhibit of a seven-headed hydra in Hamburg. And he went in there and he said, guys, this is a bunch of snake skin sewn together with a weasel skull shoved in there. This isn't a seven-headed creature. And pretty much just like that, this millennia-long belief disappeared. It was dispelled.
And the notion of science came to the fore a little bit then.
Yeah, Carl Linnaeus was kind of a, I guess, a forerunner of something called natural science, so which is kind of a melding of empirical science but also theology. I mean, his belief is that God never would have created a creature with more than one head.
It makes Scott. And he was right. Scott in Middleton's got something for us. Hi, Scott.
Hello. How are you?
Great.
So my question is simple, and Mr. Moraka, I'm a big fan of yours.
Thank you. And
so is it wrong of me to, like, you know, after I die, it's in my will that I'm going to be cremated, and then I have two new titanium hips, and that's going to be the only thing left of me after I'm cremated besides a pile of ashes.
Right.
Is it wrong that I leave one to each of my daughters?
I actually think that's a lovely idea to leave each of your titanium hips to your two daughters. And I hope you don't have three daughters, because then it's going to get complicated. but you might want to, do you want to wait until the rest of you has turned to dust? This isn't morbid at all. That's something you need to consider if it's going to involve an exhumation.
Oh, no, I'm going to be burned.
Oh, right. Of course. Sorry, you mentioned that. Well, okay. All right. I like the idea. I mean, titanium can handle that, I hope. It should be able to.
Yeah, it should be able to. Well, there have been, who was it that got shot out of a cannon? I forgot. His ashes.
Oh,
it's not in your book, but I can't remember now.
He'll go in the sequel. I do want to broach one delicate topic. Are the titanium hips being left to your daughter in lieu of, I don't know, money? Because
No way. I mean, they get whatever I got left, but the hips are just like kind of a bonus.
Well, then that's nice. I like that. That's a real parting gift.
And there are very, you know, there you've got one section where various parts of people wound up not where they, you know, somebody's jaw and somebody's finger.
Yeah, way to set me up, Scott. I really love this. Caller's really helping me along here. Yes, the book is organized so that there are essays on these people and things that deserve an appreciation. But then I have a what I call a little graveyard after each essay. So, for instance, Thomas Paine, the story of Thomas Paine, who I believe is an underrated founding father. It ends with his bones being scattered all over the world, which is true. His body was dug up in New Rochelle, New York, by a fan. You know, fans will sometimes do crazy things. And the bones ended up scattered worldwide. And so there's a section that follows the Thomas Paine essay on other disembodied body parts. They include Grover Cleveland's jaw, Galileo's middle finger, and Einstein's brain, which all were separated from the rest of their respective bodies. Grover Cleveland's jaw can be found at the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia, and it's right across the way from Chang and Eng's conjoined liver, the so-called Siamese twins, who are memorialized in the book.
Yeah, it's that's an amazing story. And Einstein's brain, it wound up disappearing after it was taken out, if I'm not mistaken. I was trying to remember what you had on it.
Yeah, exactly. It was separated. And when it was relocated, unfortunately, it didn't yield any magical discovery. It does, I guess, have supposedly a pronounced sylvan fissure. And if you have any brain surgeons listening, they're welcome to call in and explain what that means to us.
Scott, thanks again. Chris in Galena, Illinois, it's your turn.
I love Galena, Illinois. Chris, I love Galena, Illinois. The Ulysses S. Grant House there is amazing.
Well, thank you very, very much. And, of course, I have to say that it is a great, great pleasure to listen to you. Everything you've done, I know everything about. And then a double surprise, Larry Mueller, you are my Monday through Friday hero.
Oh, thank you, Chris.
I'm feeling, though, can I just jump in here? I'm feeling like Mo, Larry, and Chris. Can we just call you Shemp for this segment? Because Curly's too obvious.
I connect with him the best.
Well, you had a question, Chris.
Yes, I more of a comment. I grew up with the Mulgrew family in Dubuque, Iowa. And Beth, the McGrew family, you know, Kate McGrew, the actress.
Oh, right.
Yeah, her mother was just an absolutely fantastic artist. I must have, you know, 30 of her pieces, and she's famous all over the Midwest. The father was this incredible Red Dog, or Blue Dog? Blue Dog. Red Dog. Red Dog Democrat. And he, oh, my God, he drank like a fish. He smoked dope. He was unbelievable. And he always wore the sleeveless Loras College from Dubuque. Oh, my God, he was quite a character. Yeah, the oldest son, Tom, is an editor or probably publisher or the big honcho at a Nashville newspaper. Uh-huh. And Sam is a direct copy of his father.
There you go.
Wow, I feel like I've just attended the Mulgrew family reunion.
Chris, thanks so much.
And I'm a fan of hers, by the way, and I know that her books have been fantastic. She's been a guest on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and one of our best.
Yeah, well, which Mobit seems to be surprising readers the most?
The one, there are a few that seem to resonate with people the most. Billy Carter, I think, and I'm happy to report, people seemed moved by. I'm a big presidential history buff. It's my belief that presidential families are like ordinary families on steroids. We kind of look at them, and the dynamics we see are kind of like magnifications of the dynamics in our own families. And the contrast in relationship between Jimmy and Billy Carter is really kind of legendary. I remembered Billy Carter, frankly, as a joke, and as a caricature. And we, you know, everybody laughs about Billy Beer, which Dan Rather told me even the dogs wouldn't drink. And for those who are too young to remember, Billy Carter, 13 years younger than his older brother, President Jimmy Carter, became extremely famous in the late 70s and marketed his own beer. But no one is a caricature. And so I talked to President Carter. I talked to Billy's widow, Sybil, and his wonderful six kids. And they describe a man who was verifiably hardworking, smart, funny, complicated. And once he got his brother into some very real trouble, which is quaint by today's standards, frankly, but he admitted he was an alcoholic, and he spent the last proud chapter of his life crisscrossing the country, speaking to people who could relate to him about their own struggles with alcoholism. So Billy Carter was was really a decent person put in an extraordinary circumstance.
Mo Rocca, our guest today, his book, Mobituaries, Great Lives Worth Reliving. We have lots more to talk with him about with him, and we will do that right after we take a look at the news and weather. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Well, did you know that Herbert Hoover was a great humanitarian? Or did you know there was a Great Wall before the Great Wall of China? Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Having a great time talking with Mo Rocca about his new book. It's called Mobituaries, Great Lives Worth Reliving. Mo, a humorous correspondent for CBS Sunday morning, panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And he's also the author of the historical novel, All the President's Pets. So we have Ron from Crandon on the line, who I believe has read your book. So let's go there. Hi, Ron.
Hey, Ron.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Mo. Thanks for taking my call. I got to tell you, Mo, I'm a huge fan from all the way back to the Daily Show years.
Thank you.
I really enjoy all your stuff, and I listen to Larry pretty much every single day. And of course, today I didn't get to listen in until about quarter to 12, so missed a lot of the beginning. But I got your book the other day for my birthday. My mom said that it looked like it was written directly for me. I'm a huge history and science nerd and love all things trivial. But one of the things that I guess the comment that I wanted to make, I do a lot of local history work, and it always surprises me that reading old obituaries and you find somebody that died relatively young and there'll be an extensive obituary of what they did, yet you find some people who accomplished a lot but died when they were in their 90s, when they seem to almost have outlived their own obituaries, and there's a couple words about their passing and maybe some grandkids that survived them or something, and much of their story is missing, and that's something that I always like to go back with some of these people that really did make some major contributions and try to put their obituaries back together, you know, a lot the way that you've done. And I'm only a few pages in, but I really, really enjoyed it so far. So I just
wanted to
Ron,
thank you very much. And I absolutely agree with you. I mean, look, Hollywood reboots everything at this point. I mean, why can't we reboot obituaries and get another stab, maybe there's a better word I could come up with than stab for this, but like another shot at, God, I'm running into it every time. Anyway, another attempt at writing someone's life history. I agree. And it is interesting, in the preface of the book, I talk about Madam Chiang Kai-shek, who lived, I think, until about 105. And this was a sort of a different phenomenon where she basically was, her life kind of spanned the history of modern China. And she lived so long that I think people forgot, anyone who even knew who she was forgot that she was alive. So there you had a long obit that probably was underread and underappreciated. But Ron is also right. You have people who live long lives and just live past their heyday and then get short shrift when they die.
Thank you, Ron. Appreciate it. Janine in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Janine.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Appreciate your call.
Thank you. I appreciate you listening. I just mentioned to the woman about my sister-in-law who does the retail obituaries for entertainment because she's alone and can't drive her car at night. So, and they are stories. It's really interesting.
They are, they really are interesting stories, and I'm frankly interested more in people's beginnings than their ends. And a good obituary does really have a real vitality and a sweep to it. I mean, you're hearing the life of someone's story, and I think we're interested in them for different reasons. A good friend of mine, she said, you know, I think that a lot of people read obituaries because we all kind of wonder, will we be remembered? How will we be remembered? And so it's almost like a kind of a devotional to sit there and read and reflect on, wow, this person did this at this juncture in their lives. Would I have done the same thing? I know that sometimes I'm loathe to admit this, but I read them competitively. I'll go, wait, he did all of that by the time he was 22? Oh, I feel like such a slouch. And then you're like, oh, wait a minute, he went to prison when he was 47. I'm ahead of the game now.
There we go. Well, in thinking about that, you were talking about people that achieved a lot early in their lives. And one of the stories that kind of surprised me was the obit for Herbert Hoover that you put together, because I frankly did not have the greatest opinion of Herbert Hoover.
So Herbert Hoover, it's his story I liken to watching the movie Titanic, because you know what's coming. You know what's coming. This ship is going down. And in his case, the iceberg is the stock market crash in 1929, 8 months into his presidency. And it overshadows everything. It brands him for life. But before that stock market crash, before he was president, he was the great humanitarian, orphaned at the age of 9 from the little Quaker village of West Branch, Iowa. He shipped west on a train to be with his cold, detached relatives in Oregon. They don't give him love, but he claws his way up, and he becomes a man of great achievement, a great mining engineer. But more than that, he becomes this humanitarian. When World War I breaks out, he's living in London. He's a rich guy. He's fine. But he says, you know what? I'm going to use my resources to get 120,000 Americans trapped in Europe home. And what's more, before the U.S. enters the war, he acts as a one-man State Department to convince the British and the Germans to allow relief supplies into German-blockaded Belgium, and ends up feeding an estimated 8 to 10 million Northern Europeans. Europeans. To this day, the Herbert Hoover Library gets letters from descendants of those he saved, Belgians, who say, I'm on this earth because of Herbert Hoover. And then as Secretary of Commerce, and let's face it, a very unsexy cabinet position, he standardizes much of American life. Before he's the Secretary of Commerce, there are 66 different sizes of bricks that the construction industry uses. Incredibly inefficient. He gets it to one size. There are multiple sizes of bottles that the dairy industry uses for milk. He reduces it to four, pint, quart, half gallon, and gallon. And the three-colored traffic signal, before Herbert Hoover is Secretary of Commerce, red means stop in some places, go in another. I mean, can you imagine all these people crashing into each other? So he does all these great things for the American public and for the world, but it's all eclipsed by this terrible thing that happens. That's not his fault. We can debate how he handled the Great Depression during his short term in office, but the stock market crash surely is not his fault.
It surely is not, but I tell you, my eyes were open when I read your piece on Herbert Hoover. It was, to me, that alone made the book worth reading.
Well, we talked so much, Larry, about post-presidencies, right, and how Jimmy Carter has had a very distinguished post-presidency, but we don't talk about pre-presidencies. And unfortunately, it's considered preseason ball. Once the guy and eventually the woman is in office, that's what the public cares about, for good reason. But I'm not sure that it should eclipse all that came before. Ulysses S. Grant is the one exception. He had a pretty mediocre two terms in office, but you know, it didn't eclipse the fact that he won the Civil War for the Union.
Let's take another call. Tim in New Berlin will go to you next. Hi, Tim.
Hi, thank you. Somebody I think needs to be given a second glance is Lyndon Johnson. Now, it's my understanding that the Presidential Library, the Johnson Presidential Library, that those papers were released, according to Rachel Maddow, on the 50th anniversary, meaning 2018, regarding Lyndon Johnson's efforts to end the war in Vietnam in 1968. And that was sabotaged by Richard Nixon when Richard Nixon back-channeled to North Vietnam through Chanel. Nixon told through a back channel to North Vietnam, don't agree to Lyndon Johnson's terms, because apparently North Vietnam was ready to agree to Lyndon Johnson's terms to end the Vietnam War. But Nixon convinced the North Vietnamese not to agree to those terms because he said, well, you'll get a better deal after I'm elected. And when I found out about that, and it seems to be verifiable, this seems to be pretty much in the presidential papers, when I found out about that, my opinion of Lyndon Johnson went up a lot.
Yeah.
That, everybody always thought, well, here's this guy who was the mastermind behind Vietnam. He almost, if it hadn't been for Nixon, that war might have ended in 1968. And when I found out about that, my opinion of Johnson went up. And that was the reason he didn't want to run for reelection, is because he put the country ahead of his own personal political ambitions. What do you think about that, sir?
Well, I think, first of all, if I've talked to Doris Kearns Goodwin, who worked for Lyndon Johnson about this, and I'm pretty sure that she's in agreement with you. I haven't spoken specifically about that. And he's somebody I would certainly like to write about if there's a sequel to this book. It never fails to surprise me, or maybe I'm no longer surprised, I should say, at what people will do for power. I mean, I think the history of the presidency is littered with examples like this. And not to turn this into the Herbert Hoover hour, but it was important for Franklin Delano Roosevelt to keep Hoover as the bogeyman, who was responsible for the Great Depression in order to marshal support for FDR himself. So this doesn't surprise me. I don't know enough on this topic. I do know that there are a lot of people. There's been a lot of Johnson revisionism. And I think sort of the conventional wisdom is you know, great leader on civil rights, undone by Vietnam. That's become sort of the shorthand for Johnson. But what you bring up adds even more intrigue and complication and heartbreak to the situation.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling. Jeff in New Berlin emailed to say he spends his summers in central Wisconsin, gets the local paper, the Washera Argus, always reads the obits because they are beautifully written.
Very nice.
Yeah, very nice thing.
And you know, Larry, I went to ObitCon, which is the convention of obituary writers, a lot more fun than Comic-Con. I really mean it. And when you go there, you have to be careful not to confuse obituaries with paid death notices. They're very sensitive if you talk about paid obits, because they say, no, those are paid death notices. Those are a different thing. However, paid death notices are the lifeblood of a lot of small newspapers now, because you pay for them, obviously.
Yeah.
And it's keeping a lot of papers going.
We have, I have lots more to talk about with you. And Nixon comes up in your book as well, in a way, by
Richard
the way.
Nixon.
Yes, Richard Nixon.
Yes, Richard Nixon comes up.
In the Mount Rushmore
of terrible presidents. Look, yeah. I try to keep this book largely positive. I believe that obituaries are the one place left in journalism where the rule of thumb is generosity, giving people the benefit of the doubt. But I did create a series of Mount Rushmores, a Mount Rushmore of pre-presidencies, a Mount Rushmore of post-presidencies, and then Mount Rushmore of terrible presidents. James Buchanan was a lock on that one. He's just the worst. But I did also include, in a nod to the modern presidency, I did indeed include Richard Nixon, with the caveat that he did do good things, like the establishment of the EPA and opening the door to China. And I also will submit that a lot of people don't like Nixon because he had kind of a lousy personality and a real propensity to sweat, and that's not fair to hold that against him. But then, of course, there was Watergate, and, you know, that was pretty bad.
You have a number of interesting women that history has kind of forgotten. One that I had read, I don't know if you read Jennifer Cheverini's book titled Enchantress of Numbers, about Ada Lovelace.
Right. Well, so Ada Lovelace is somebody I learned about on one of my other jobs as host of the Henry Ford's Innovation Nation, which is a Saturday morning show on CBS, which is a weekly kind of tribute to the history of innovation in America. And in Dearborn, Michigan, of course, is where the Henry Ford Museum is, and such an amazing place. And I learned about Ada Lovelace there, the daughter of Lord Byron, the great poet. She is also responsible for what was later on seen as the very first computer program in the world. And she did this at a very young age. She died when she was in her 30s. So she was what I call a forgotten forerunner. People that maybe were so far ahead of their times, they're not remembered. I think in the case of Ada Lovelace, it was a combination of her both being a woman, but also people not really understanding the significance of what she'd done while she was alive. Those are two contributing factors to her having been forgotten.
Well, we're pondering that. We had Scott in La Crosse with a question.
Hi, Scott.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I've seen a documentary about a president I really knew nothing about. It was James Garfield, and it was excellent. And they had said that probably if he hadn't been assassinated and died in office, that he would have been one of our top five presidents. I was wondering what you thought of that.
Well, James Garfield, who I guess had been the president of Williams College, and there's an apocryphal story about him. But I bet the actual truth is not far from this. But the story is that he could write Latin in his right hand while he was writing ancient Greek in his left simultaneously. Garfield was murdered by Charles Guiteau pretty early in his presidency. There's a wonderful book by Candace Millard about his life and death, and one of the terrible things about it is that Alexander Graham Bell had recently invented the metal detector, and they were trying to find where the bullet was lodged in him. And when they put it over his prone body on a bed, the metal detector, it kept beeping continuously. And then later on, they realized that it was the wireframe mattress that was setting it off. I mean, right? What a bummer. Because otherwise, they might have found the bullet. But, you know, one of the ironies about this, and there's sort of a connection in the book here, is he succeeded by his vice president, Chester Alan Arthur, who's, you may know for his mutton chops, like real hipster mutton chops, like pretty amazing facial hair. But he'd been a pretty corrupt guy. He'd run New York's customs house, so he was used to getting a lot of kickbacks. But he was so horrified by what had happened. Charles Guiteau was a frustrated office seeker when he murdered Garfield, that Chester Alan Arthur made it his mission to pass major civil service reform to take the politics out of civil service. So there was at least a very thin silver lining. As for how he would have been in office, I don't know. I mean, he was a Garfield. He was a really, really smart guy, by all accounts, a very decent man.
Scott, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, we haven't mentioned Audrey Hepburn, and that was her early life was another early life that I knew nothing about.
Well, Audrey Hepburn is somebody I wrote about for a couple of reasons. One of which is that when I was 23 years old, I worked behind the fragrance counter at Macy's department store in New York's Herald Square, one of the busiest department stores in the world. And one day in April of 1993, Audrey Hepburn walked by my counter. The entire retail floor, one of the busiest in the world, fell silent. Even if people had had cell phones back then, you never would have thought to shove your hand in front of her face for a selfie. There was just something about her. A few months later, she died on the same day that Bill Clinton was inaugurated. She was pushed off the front page. I got to interview President Clinton for this, and he was genuinely shocked when I told him that Audrey Hepburn had died on the day of his inauguration. He wasn't aware of that. Granted, he was busy that day. But what I really wanted to know is why Audrey Hepburn trends on Twitter regularly, why she's still so much part of more than a quarter century after her death, why people still remember her so fondly. And I talked to both of her sons, and they agreed that almost starving to death in Nazi-occupied Holland during World War II was foundational to her whole being. This is not fan fiction. She really did perform in secret dance performances to raise money for the resistance. When I went back after hearing about her experience during the war and I looked at her movies, I saw in her eyes a kind of yearning and a kind of gratitude that I think is what makes her punch through the screen and what made us all fall in love with her and continue to be in love with her. The studios tried to copy her, just like Hollywood always does. They found other beautiful, talented actresses like Millie Perkins, Susan Strasberg, Maggie McNamara. None of them connected with the public. And if you go onto YouTube and you find Audrey Hepburn's original screen test in Hollywood, she's not talking about how excited she is to be in Hollywood and to make movies. She's talking about the war. It was central to who she was. And Otto Frank, the father of Anne Frank, gave her the unpublished manuscript of the Diary of Anne Frank to read before it was published because he wanted her to play his daughter at one point. And Audrey Hepburn thanked him and said, "I can't do this because I think it would literally kill me because her story is so painful." And Audrey Hepburn, though, of course, she survived the war, felt such a connection to that, with someone of such deep sensitivity, that she thought it would literally kill her to play that role.
Mo, this has been a wonderful 45 minutes. I want to thank you so much for the book and all the work you do. I really appreciate it. And by the way, Mark from Wauwatosa said it was Hunter S. Thompson who was shot out of a cannon by Johnny Depp.
Oh, my my goodness, that's right. That's right. I need a whole, maybe I'll throw Evel Knievel in there. I need a whole chapter on people being shot out of cannons. Larry, I want to thank you, and I want to thank the people of Wisconsin. And if anyone wants to take me to a supper club, just let me know. I went to the 5 o'clock steakhouse in Milwaukee once, and it was terrific. The prime rib couldn't be beat.
Mo, I hope we have a chance to talk again. Thank you so much. Mobituaries, Great Lives Worth Reliving. I highly recommend this book, the author, Mo Rocca. And thank you all for listening. And, hey, please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I am Larry Mueller.